The time will come when the human race will have to face itself in the mirror and decide what it is to be human. They will have to make a choice. They will face their greatest enemy, an enemy that stops at nothing, listens to no one. They will have to fight for their survival. Nothing is beyond its depraved and immoral intention. It takes many forms. It kills, maims, and destroys without remorse. It cannot be understood. It cannot be reasoned with. It cannot be defeated when it is fought head-on in the battlefield. It seeps and writhes its way through society, leaving husks of humanity where once there were people. Men, women, children, all a prey to it. But in the future, the people of the world state that enough is enough. If blood is to be spilled, then it has to be worth the sacrifice. It has to be with the intention of the total and utter extermination of the enemy. All means, laws, powers, and weaponry are at their disposal. Nothing must stand in their way. They are the saviors of the human race. They are the destroyers of the enemy. They are the Faith Seekers.
The Faith Seekers by Greg James. Available now on Amazon and Lulu, paperback or ebook. Download it now.
There are a thousand ways to die, and the Faith Seekers know them all.
Welcome to Doctor Who On Target. The podcast where we discuss the target range of classic Doctor Who novelizations from the 1970s and 80s. Those long ago days where, if you missed Doctor Who on TV, you missed it forever. Unless, of course, you bought the Target novelisation. So, join us, jump aboard the TARDIS, set the time rotor for late 20th century Earth, and, with a wheezing, groaning sound, we'll discuss Doctor Who on Target. Hello and welcome to Doctor Who On Target. This is Greg in Swansea.
And this is David in Chelmsford. As our regular listeners will know, we've dipped back into the archive of BBC Books' Target audio range to bring you our thoughts on Doctor Who and the Giant Robot by Terence Dix and Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters by Malcolm Hulk. This podcast we're looking at a very early Patrick Troughton story, namely Jerry Davis's Doctor Who, The Highlanders. The Target novelisation of The Highlanders was published on the 15th of November 1984, the original author Jerry Davis adapting his story from his script, co-written with Elwyn Jones. This serial is completely missing from the BBC's archive.
Yeah.
Now, Greg, you describe Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters as a meaty Target novelisation.
Yeah.
And what I'd like to know first is The Highlanders similarly meaty, or is it suitable for vegetarians?
Well, I think it is suitable for vegetarians, actually. It's interesting that you say meaty, because if you like maybe a dryish version of historical facts, then I think it could be considered to be a little meaty. But I will have to say that this story, I am completely unfamiliar with it. Obviously, I've never seen the story. It doesn't exist at all. I've never read the Target novelisation prior to this. I knew nothing about it other than Jamie joined the crew and that there were some, I'd read some brief synopses of it.
Mm.
So, yeah, so completely unfamiliar. So when I started listening to the audio version of it, I will say I found it a little bit overload because it's not a piece of history with which I'm familiar.
Mm.
So I struggled to know what was going on. I'm briefly aware of the sort of political shenanigans that were going on between Scotland and England at this time, but very, very vaguely. So I found it a bit of a school lesson and a little bit dull when I first started listening to it. Yeah.
And that's interesting, because that sort of ties in with the idea of early Doctor Who being didactic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting you say about the didactic bits. I felt they were dropped in a bit. It was almost as if, you know, you're sort of going along with the story and then the teacher stops you to say, now, the reason this was happening was because the young pretender was actually... And I just felt, oh, you've taken me right out of the story here, just as I was getting in. Yeah, for...
Yes. I mean, my own feeling about it is that it's certainly a fast-paced novelisation with many quite short chapters. Initially, I assume this approach intentionally slight on Jerry Davis's part, but perhaps the TV version has more visual elements that beef it up, such as battle scenes and the like.
Yeah, yeah. What I liked, for you know, as we get further into the story with the Annabelle, the ship, the Annabelle, and so forth, and there's a bit of swashbuckling, and there's a bit of derring do, and there's sword fights and so forth. I had the impression that perhaps... on screen, as you've already said, it would actually be a bit of a faster paced feel to it. Sword fights, I think, are quite difficult to realise in sort of written form, aren't they? I think you've got to be a bit of a master of the art to get that right, because, you know, it can just be repetitive. How do you make a sword fight exciting on paper, you know?
Yes. They put all the watery stuff in there so they could use the water tank at Ealing. Oh. All the stuff around the ship was filmed at Ealing, as was the underwater menace, which is the following story.
One part which I did love was when Ben was captured and put in bonds and he escaped, and he used an old trick that he'd been taught in the Navy, wasn't it? And for a while after that, they didn't tell you the trick, and I was going, I want to know what the trick is, I want to know. And of course, a little later on, he does reveal to Polly what the trick was, isn't it? And yeah, she's a bit suspicious, saying, I think there's more to it than that, but you're not saying. I love that, because that's something which, one of the elements I love in the old Target novels of these, I think we've mentioned it before, sort of lovely little classic ways of, you know, escapism, or of solving a puzzle, or of finding out something. You know, I love those little parts. So I say I picked up more pleasures going throughout the story than I anticipated with the first disc.
I mean, regarding your own reception of the writing, I shall confess to being a little concerned about Alexander's early description of the TARDIS crew, who were mistaken for camp followers of the Duke of Cumberland, who'd come to steal from the dead. But of course, this word is not being used in the two robots with malfunctioning personalities from Dinosaurs on a Spaceship context.
I very much felt that this story was a one-sided school view.
Ah, well, it's funny you should say that, because I've got my own quite strong thoughts on that.
Oh, right, yeah, cool. Let's hear them, David.
Now, I could be reading too much into what is essentially children's literature, yet I sense a complete lack of impartiality in the way the story is told, by which I mean that the Scots are portrayed as oppressed, lion-hearted freedom fighters, whilst the English characters are a bunch of oafish, duplicitous and corrupt occupiers.
Right.
I can only think that this arises out of some Celtic solidarity on the part of the authors.
Really?
The name Jerry Davis sounding a bit Welsh, and the name Elwyn Jones sounding as Welsh as Mam's leek pie. In fact, the line between the goodies and baddies of this story is so firmly drawn that, rather than being given rounded characters, the whole thing plays out as something of a pantomime. Yeah. Add to that the Doctor's appearance in drag, and the fact that the story transmitted either side of Christmas Day 1966, and the illusion is quite complete.
Yeah, that's really good. I like that, David, actually, yeah.
I think I should say that since hatching my suspicion of Celtic bias,
yes,
I found out that Jones's contribution to the Highlanders was little more than a few notes, which it fell to Jerry Davis to craft into a workable television script.
Yeah.
So it's a joint writing credit, but what we're actually seeing is the work of Jerry Davis, really.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I wouldn't have thought the work of Jerry Davis would have been so much like this, because of course, you know, he's a man of ideas, wasn't he? He was a man of
Man who was interested in science, wasn't he? I think the truth of it was that Elwin Jones was quite a flavoursome name at the time, and so to have him write for Doctor Who was a bit of a coup.
Oh, really?
And the fact that he scarcely did was unfortunate. Mm. As I said in the introduction, to the best of our knowledge, this story isn't held in the BBC archive.
No. No.
So, has experiencing Annika Will's reading of Jerry Davis's novelisation moved the story up or down on your wish list of missing episode returns?
Right, now that is a very interesting question. Previously, the Highlanders didn't figure at all in my thoughts on Doctor Who. You know, returned episodes. If you were to ask me which ones do you want to see back, it would never even cross my mind. However, despite Annika's reading of this story, more of which later, I it's brought it more to my attention. I think, as we discussed earlier, I think it could be a bit of a nice swashbuckling tale, perhaps, you know. It's because I do love historical Doctor Who, you know. I do love those ones where, you know, like the Aztecs we had previously, and Marco Polo, and I love those ones, and they're great.
Well, aside from the telesnaps, our only insight into how this story might have looked on television comes from a couple of brief clips, I think they're from episode one, that were removed by the Australian censor and then rediscovered many years later. It seems to me hugely ironic that we can only see these because somebody else didn't want others to.
Yes.
I think it goes without saying that any further recoveries of black and white Doctor Who material would be extremely welcome.
Yes.
And having now assumed the power of the Daleks to be lost forever, the return of an episode or four of the Highlanders would seem beyond magical after all these years missing in action.
Yes, yeah. But I think the problem is, when you see them in written format, as this one has been done, it can be a bit incendiary if you are someone like me who, I don't like black and white stories told like this, you know. I find it's a bit, you know, we see it all the time. I mean, it's not... I think I've mentioned before, you know, we both absolutely adore Shakespeare, you know, and it makes me mad when I think, when I was a child in school and I learnt so much Shakespeare by rote, and I didn't understand a single word of it. And it was only later on, when rereading it myself, that I discovered that why it was such wonderful poetry, so cleverly and intensely intelligently told, you know, because, you know, because he never gave that side of things. He didn't say, oh, this is history and this is what it is. This is the single viewpoint, which I feel we get in this. Though strangely, I think we do have a bit of a, you know, would you say that it comes across as being biased? Is that what you're feeling about the story?
Yes, I don't like, as you say, I think I like my stories to be a bit more nuanced.
Yes.
Than this one perhaps is. But again, we have to get some perspective on it and remember that it is essentially something that's aimed at children.
Yeah, yeah.
And children are perhaps less interested in nuanced storytelling than you or I.
That's a very good point, actually, because, yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's a target novel, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes, as well. And anything that encourages a reconnection with these long-lost days of Doctor Who has got to be a positive.
Though having said that, this is the problem, you see. Having said that, immediately about 7 or 8 target novelisations of Doctors just sprang to mind, where we had dealt clear, interesting, understandings of concepts of living and, you know, who, what it means to be foreign and xenophobic and all the... We have got all of that in many Target novels because we've talked about it before, the wonderful Terence Dix, the wonderful cave monsters again.
We're coming full circle, aren't we, down to the lack of meat. Or maybe it's a different meat. Maybe it's a Linda McCartney sausage, this one. So it's meat, but not meat.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yes, yeah.
But it's certainly not a Nando's chicken, is it?
No. I've never had a Nando's chicken, but I'll take your word for it, David. Going back to the subject of Annika Wills' reading of it, I mean, I've got in my notes here, I mean, and please, Annika, forgive me, because I've met you quite a few times and I love you to bits. And I did feel that this one, I've got, well, you know, you mentioned pantomime earlier, you know, I feel she puts a huge amount of effort into it, but there's a... They are quite pantomimic, you know. There's an awful lot of stereotyped-sounding people within it, you know. It's like, I mean, there's Scottish accents, you know, especially when she's doing the doctor dressed as a Scottish woman. And they're way over the top, you know. They're really, are they so embarrassed? They're the sort of thing that, you know, you'd expect, you'd see it on one of these programmes where they would say, you'd never see this on the TV these days because it's too politically incorrect, you know. You know, it's a difficult thing because I don't think she gave the voices any particular emphasis. You know, I don't think she was... They might be stereotyped, but I don't think she was being racist or biased because everybody had the same treatment. You know, you had a Scottish accent, which was incredibly, you know, over the top. But then Ben's accent, which he could do, you know, she was doing Ben. He was a proper old Cockney, straight out of Mary Poppins. And, you know, it was, she was doing it with all of them. So it wasn't. Do you think so, David? Or
I mean, I think I'm going to be slightly more generous to Annika than perhaps you're being.
Right.
Because there were an awful lot of characters in this story.
Yeah.
And I thought she did rather well to give them all a reasonably distinctive voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I do. But I do take on board what you're saying. Captain Trask.
Yeah.
He's a proper pirate, isn't he? He should be in Doctor Who and the Smugglers.
He is, yeah.
He's a proper seafaring an old sea dog.
But, you know, it was quite interesting because there's a line in there. You know, you were saying about the didactic quality of, you know, this story. There's quite a bit of didacticism in it. Well, I rather liked some of it because I love to find out little bits and pieces, you know. Like, for example... there's a line in there where I think it's the doctor or somebody, I think it might be is accused of being as bold as a Welsh pirate. And I thought...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I thought, that's an... I'm being Welsh. I thought, I haven't heard that one before. And I did a little bit of research. And, of course, there was an extremely famous, I believe it was Captain Morgan.
Yes.
Who was one of the most notorious pirates. Of the whole lot. I had no idea he was Welsh.
He even sounds Welsh, doesn't he, with that name?
Well, this is the thing, you know, it didn't occur to me, David, but yeah, so I thought that's quite interesting. That's quite...
if it's increased the sum of your own knowledge about your homeland, then I don't see how this can be a bad thing at all.
Yeah, exactly. And another one where we encounter the cannon and they said it's been spiked.
Yeah.
And... is that where we get the term something's been spiked from? It's been, you know, because they actually put a spike inside.
Hammer a spike down the barrel to stop it from working anymore.
Yeah, that's great. I love all of that sort of thing, you see. That's really interesting. Now, that's when the teacher's being great and really good. I love that. But it's only when, you know, it goes to a bit of a narrow-minded... view of things that it starts to sort of rub me up the wrong way, you know.
Talking about rubbing you up the wrong way, I think we need to tackle the elephant in the room on this audio, or another elephant in the room, which is the soundscape.
Oh.
What did you make of that?
Well, if there's water, there's got to be water sounds. If there's coins, there's got to be coins chinking away. If there's a pub, There's got to be people being beaten up and metal mugs smashed. And we've been talking recently of the older Audio Go Doctor Who target novelizations of being having really good soundscapes and being really well thought out. You know, we've had some beautiful ones lately, really well done. And I thought with this one, there were times where we had a nice little, you know, whenever we went into the scenes with the Annabelle, the water was swishing away. But it was just like I said, with the coins counting, do we really need coins tinkling in your ear to hear Annika Will saying he counted out the coins? I think there was a little bit of it's not as well done as the other ones. I think it's a bit too much. What did you think, David?
Well, no, I'm absolutely in agreement with you. I think that the number of inconsequential noises that appear in the soundscape make it somewhat overcooked.
The
one example where it actually works and does assist the story is when the Doctor plays Lily Bolero March on the tin whistle.
Yes.
Because I wouldn't have understood what that tune was.
Yes, me neither.
And there's also a really good bit of comedy from that, because when the guard is thoroughly wound up and murderous, he passes the whistle to Jamie and lets him take the rap for it.
Yeah. I like that. That was pretty good, actually. Yeah, that was a good use of it, isn't it? That's the way it should be done. But yeah, I like your idea that it was overcooked with some of them. Yeah, it's just that literalism which we've had before, isn't it? We've encountered sometimes where, you know, there's no need for particular effects to be put on. You know, it's almost as if they hear keywords sometimes and go, the glass smashed, gotta put smashing glass on, you know. It's like there's not a need unless it calls for it to further or enhance the story,
I think that this one was the first one that had a sort of a blanket soundtrack behind it that we've heard for a while.
Yeah.
Because as you say, it really did. If they're up on the moor, it had a whooshing wind.
Yeah.
Sort of in the background, and as you say, if they were at sea, they had choppy waves going. If they were in a pub, they had all the noises of the pub, including emptying the beer barrel.
Yes, yeah.
And as you say, the chatter.
Yeah.
It's almost as if they thought Annika couldn't tell us that they'd gone to a pub and that we'd believe her, which is quite disingenuous to her, really.
Do you know, it is, because even though I know you said I've been a bit, you know, ungenerous with Hugo, but the energy which she put into this was fabulous. You know, she put a huge amount of energy. She did try to bring alive a large amount of characters. And, you know, she must have had a few sides of A4 of different characters to do the different voices going on there. Mm. So, you know, you can't take that away from her there at all, you know. It's just, but what, like I say, she didn't need a lot of those sound effects. She was doing a very good job of reading it. It was, but what was irritating to me, and the annoying thing is, when she was doing Pat Troughton's Doctor sometimes, because she knows the nuances of his voice, she knows her, and I thought, oh, you just got that it is how he says it. And I love that. And she did it a few times with Ben and Jamie, and I thought that was really good. But then when she was doing the parts of the Doctor when he was dressed in his various different disguises, of which we'll talk about a bit later, she was going over the top with it. It was too much, you know, with the, I don't know. It didn't work for me. I felt it was too over the top when she was doing those voices.
So I'm almost scared to mention him now, because my next question would be, how did you receive the portrayal of Patrick Troughton's Doctor in the story? Are there any particular moments in the Highlanders that stood out for you, especially regarding the Doctor's involvement?
Well, now that's a really interesting question, David, because is this the second Patrick Troughton story, I think?
Yes, it is.
So he's new. Now, we've just had Power of the Daleks. And
that's all we've had.
And we know that the Doctor was regenerated in there and trying to find him, you know, his new character. And we also know that Pat Troughton was very keen to play different characters in there. And I feel I feel they've given him a lot of opportunities in this one. You know, he plays so many different ones, but oh, I don't know. It's not the Pat Troughton that I know at all. Multiple personalities are being used again with, you know, the voices. I mean, I don't know what the voices were like which Pat Troughton actually used. I mean, actually, maybe Annika was actually copying the way that Pat Troughton did them. I don't know.
Well, we do have the audio in existence, don't we? So we could actually find that out. And as I said earlier, there are some telesnaps from which we can see the costumes that he puts on.
Yeah.
The very famous one of him as the washerwoman.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes. Perhaps I should have taken a listen to those and got hold of them. So.
Well, there's time.
Yeah. But I think, I don't know, there were... Having said that, I did love the comedy moments, you know, with the head bashing on the table. You've got a head.
Oh, well, I do want to mention this because I'm going to read my note here.
Yeah.
And then you can react to it.
Okay.
I've put, he seems to be a trickster and a master of disguise who is not averse to using physical violence or threatening others with weapons. He abandons his commitment to not changing history quite spectacularly by hatching the plot to liberate the Annabelle from the evil clutches of Captain Trask.
Mm.
He chooses a side and is instrumental in assisting the flight of Jamie's associates to France. These are not actions in which the First Doctor would have indulged, I feel sure.
Oh, that, yes, yeah. No, I have to agree with you entirely there, David, yeah. It is true, and you can be sure of that, you know, he wouldn't have done... I mean, it's very different, and I've made notes of where I feel he is being the Doctor. So it's interesting, isn't it, that I'm searching for bits where I can find Pat Troughton's Doctor, and you've amassed a larger cull than I have of areas where he isn't being what we perceive to be the Doctor. So so obviously it seems like the balance isn't quite right in here. I mean, I'm sure on TV, if we could see that now, they could be having a whale of a time. Pat Troughton could be loving it. You know.
Well,
could...
again, you know, coming back to my notes, that is exactly the next thing I wrote. I thought, what must have come over better on TV than it did in the audiobook? Was Patrick Troughton employing his acting skills to create the characters? Yeah. You've got Dr. Von Wehr, Doctor of Who in translation.
Ah.
You've got the Washerwoman and the English Sentry.
Yes, yeah.
I think these were sort of gifted to him to, as you say, to allow him to explore and to actually utilise his sort of repertoire of characters, or at least his ability to morph into characters.
Some of where I thought it was poor Pat Troughton was the part where he shouts out, he seems to be on the side of one side or the other, whichever it was, and he shouts out in the cave, doesn't he?
Yes, in the dungeon he shouts something like, down with Prince George or whatever it was, they take him to be... Yes, they take him to be on their side.
That's right. And then he just gives that little line of going, oh, not really, I just like listening to the echo, you know, and...
Oh, yes, that was, you see, that was mischievous, that was the trickster.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah, I loved that, that was really good. And of course we have another one a bit later, which is when the Doctor, who is it, the man who's been wounded and they're trying to...
Laird Collin.
That's it, Laird Collin. And he's lying there, you know, and they say about, they're letting blood, and of course the Doctor... Yeah, of course they know that this is a really bad idea, but he gets around it beautifully and in period, I think, by saying about, oh no, the stars, you know, no, what is he? Oh, he's a...
Yes, he uses some cod medicine to make Jamie back down, doesn't he?
That's right, of course. And of course, it fits in. It gets the desired effect of stopping them bloodletting him to give him a chance to survive and get better. But of course he gives that mischievous little wink, isn't it, when they say, I didn't know you believed in that. So I love that. Again, these are lovely ones, which are pure patroten, and I think the ones which you highlighted earlier are showing that's not quite what we think of as patroten.
You see, it was a short-lived motif for this doctor, yeah, that Jerry Davis, in the context of the book, says the doctor was very fond of hats. It was a standing joke in the TARDIS that he could never resist trying on any new hat he came across.
Ah,
you see, and this came out of an ad-lib that Patrick Troughton did in the recording, where he said, "I should like a hat like that," in episode one, about the Tam O'Shanter.
Yes.
And then he repeats it later in the story. And it's just, as I say, it's short-lived, but it was a quirk. It was a new thing for the Doctor to experiment, because we all know that Patrick Troughton didn't want to appear as himself, wanted a disguise.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And this sort of brings that home to us, how eager he was to obscure his face, the fact he'd wear any hat he could get his hands on.
Yeah.
But again, looking in the book, I think Jerry Davis gives a rather lovely description of the Doctor when he's tricking them into thinking that he knows where Bonnie Prince Charlie is. He says, "Would I have come here and placed my life in your hands if I'd not been very sure?" said the Doctor, his green eyes wide open, projecting the childlike candour he could turn on when he wanted to. I thought that was lovely.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was lovely. And actually, I thought the reading that Annika did of it was lovely, because that it stood out in my head. One, I thought I wasn't aware that Patron had green eyes.
No, I wasn't, because he was always in black and white on my telly.
And me too, yeah. What a coincidence. And and when I heard that, I thought, that's a lovely description of it, because he can do that. That's what his character does too, isn't it?
Yes.
So obviously Jerry Davis had had got a fix on this character very early on to do this, I think.
Mm.
I like that. Although, of course, the book was written several years later, wasn't it? So
a good 15 years later, wasn't it?
Oh, so maybe, you know, maybe that was a bit of retrofitting, is it? Maybe.
Yes, retrofitting.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know.
I did love that description of childlike candor.
It's lovely. It's really perfect. Nice. Yeah, it's spot on. I'm going from, you know, the sublime to the ridiculous now. What did you think of the head bashing table?
I felt a bit sorry for the character on the receiving end.
Yeah.
Because I felt that he was more sinned against than sinning, although he did sort of delight in seniority by proxy, didn't he? He did revel in the fact that he was the underling to the main villain of the story.
Yes.
But it did seem rather unfair to give the man a headache.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because as we know, any blow to the head is very, very dangerous.
Absolutely.
So to do it repeatedly is really naughty.
And that's the sort of thing. I was about to say we wouldn't see that these days.
Well,
but
you say that, but there was that one called The Eaters of Light, where Bill clubbed the Doctor on the back of the head. And I objected to that because I said it was mimicable violence.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we would see it these days, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and you were right, David. And I remember now as well, what was the one with James Corden where they were head-butting each other? Which I couldn't believe seeing that, because I thought, especially with the amount of young children who love Matt Smith, I thought, I can't believe that's got past, you know, the powers that be at the BBC to think that that's okay, you know, or am I being oversensitive?
I tell you what you're being, and so am I, and that's an old fuddy-duddy.
Oh.
But there's nothing new in that. We've been behaving like that for ages.
That's true. and I'll give you an example of my old fuddy-duddiness now, because I've got yet another thing I said about Annika Willis's reading, and I said it was a very Jack and Ori performance. But I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, because I used to love Jack and Ori. How does that come across to you, David?
I think that's a compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, Bernard Cribbins or Kenneth Williams on Jack and Ori.
Oh, wonderful.
That was as good as it got in childhood, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm reading back my notes and I thinking, I didn't mean that to sound, you know, anything other than complimentary, you know, but I thought maybe, so please, people who are not familiar with Jack and Ori, because I know we have listeners all around the world, what was it, David?
It was a slot that was on children's television every day about 10 to 15 minutes long. And over the course of a week, they'd tell you, what would you call it, condensed. So it would be abridged version of a book that you could then source. And in fact, the BBC published some of those books to tie in with the stories that were being told. So it was really just a... I mean, actors used to love it because they reached a big audience when they used to read on Jack and Rory. And it was educational.
Yeah, and they were of the highest calibre, the actors who appeared on it, David, didn't they?
Absolutely. Julie Dench did it a few times, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone had a go at who was anyone in the profession in those days.
Yeah.
I think Peter Davison even did it. It was that prestigious.
Yeah, yeah. It's great, isn't it? And I love Jack and Rory, so anybody, you know, if they look that up and they think I'm putting Annika down for that, it's not. It's a great compliment. I loved her. David, I wonder if I could ask you, moving on from that one, we have the this piece at the end, the last chapter or so, regarding the lock of hair.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's obviously a little bit of love interest going on there.
Do you know, that's exactly what I thought.
Right.
Yes.
Did you?
Yes, absolutely. I think that although Lieutenant Algernon Finch is a bit of a silly arse, and he is.
Yeah.
I think that Polly tames him.
Right.
And I think that there are feelings there, and I think that the feelings are mutual.
Ah.
But I also think that he's too repressed to show it, but he lets her off when he could clap her in irons at the end and bring the whole crew down. And he knows he's got to answer to his commanding officer, forgotten his name, Colonel Atwood.
Yeah.
He knows he's got to go back and say they haven't captured Bonnie Prince Charlie. But out of, I assume it's love or affection or feelings, he lets them all off.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a lovely little moment. And we actually, in the audio, we have a little bit of stock music put in around that, don't we, to give us a bit of a hint. No, we didn't need the hint, actually, but you know, a bit of a hint about the lock of hair. But I thought it was a nice little moment, actually.
Well, we should really ought to talk about this in the context of the story's theme, but it goes from being her... Well, it is. It's her releasing her hold on him, but being allowed to keep the souvenir that one, or one of the souvenirs that her possession of that souvenir once terrified him.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Coming in at the end of the story, just when we think everything's going pretty much over, it was a nice little...
It was a callback to what had happened in far earlier, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, but it was planted all that way back earlier, wasn't it? So it was quite good, actually.
It was a good moment, yes, I agree with you.
I have to say, listening to your comments and understandings of it, and I know we do this to each other sometime, but the story is going up a bit in my estimation, and I will say that... I really would quite like, actually, now, going back to one of your earlier questions, to see this one. I mean, of course I'd like to see it, but my interest is piqued, you know. I'm thinking this could actually be one of those ones we never thought would be good, but actually is really a good watch,
yes,
you know.
Yes, a gem, a hidden gem.
Nice description.
It could be. But we've touched upon it, so let's bring it out into the open. The story's themes.
Right.
For me, as usual, there's one theme in this story, and it's conflict. Not only the clash of nations, but also a clash between centuries, sexes, and social classes. It seemed to me that Ben was the alpha male of the group, and he seems to have tension with the liberated 60s chick, Polly. And he's got a chip on his shoulder about her social status and demeanour, while she resents his assumption of control based upon his gender and superior physical strength.
Right. Yeah.
And then you've got Polly's rebelliousness rubbing off on the usually reserved and subservient Kirsty.
Yes, now that, you see, this is fascinating, actually. This is why I think this story would bear fruit to listen to a few times, because I think it's got hidden depths, and you've just brought some of those depths out, because there's clearly a lot of social construction being shown here, you know, in the story. And like you said, that clash of, did you say cultures and times? And do you know, it's really interesting, because I think if you were to do an essay on this and presenting it academically like that, I think it would bear fruit. I think you could do it. It just, the more you think about that, it's got things there to be able to get your teeth into, keeping up with the culinary theme we have going with the language of this podcast. I have to be honest, a lot of those things went over my head. I didn't, I didn't dig deep enough into it, I think, to...
Well, you mentioned one of the key moments of it earlier, because you spoke about Ben delighting in demonstrating how he escaped his bonds underwater using a Houdini technique of flexing his muscles at the appropriate moment and then loosening them to make the ropes fall away. And he's also terribly proud of the fact that he's got such a variety of swimming strokes as well. So that's another strength and ability and sort of sporting prowess thing. It mentions him learning a rare stroke at the London Baths with his dad, which is to swim on his side. So he does crawl breaststroke. He swims on his back when he's tired.
Yeah.
And he swims on his side. So it's obviously a Herculean task to swim back to the shore, which he has accomplished.
Yeah, that was quite an exciting... I liked that. It was. And I loved the callback, you know, remembering we're in this period in time, and then it calls right back to that London Baths, isn't it? Which is really nice, you know, I like that. Mm. And then it did actually put what Ben is, a sailor in the Navy, you know, straight back into your mind, you know. And so I was with him all the way when he was going that show. And that piece where he said, did he describe him like a beached whale? Was it like a beach whale or something he said?
Something along those lines when he got onto the jetty, didn't he? And he meets the doctor.
Yeah, because he was so excited, so exhausted that he was like, oh, I can't do any more. This has taken it out of me. And of course, it was the doctor. Mm. He got lucky, yeah. So I rather like that, actually, yeah.
He sort of manages to put Jamie down as well, doesn't he?
Yes.
Again, a bit reading from the book, it said... Ben turned to Jamie as the boat pulled away. Quick, he said. We can swim for it. Jamie didn't answer. Well, Ben demanded. Jamie shook his head. I can't swim, he admitted. Oh, cripes. Ben turned away, disgusted.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So the fact that, you know, that the young pretender can't match him disgusts him.
Yeah.
Which I thought was rather good. So that's a power relationship as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I'm going to confess that I've never been a big fan of Jamie McCrimmon.
Oh.
And even less so since discovering that his late addition to the TARDIS crew robbed Michael Craze of dialogue written for Ben in subsequent stories.
Really? Good gosh.
Based upon this story alone, do you see companion potential in the character of Jamie? And what was your own reception of Fraser Hines' performance and his overall contribution to the Troughton era?
Well, what a question. I mean, that's a podcast in itself, David, isn't it? That's, I mean, shock horror. Not many people would say that about Jamie and Ben's characters, I think. Right. Now, based only on this story, no, it doesn't jump out at me that Jamie is the character who is going to be the companion to Pat Troughton. I think, you know, Ben very much is the action hero, alpha male person within here. And he shows he's got a lot of skills and capability to carry that role within it, you know. I'd love you to explain why you feel that way about Jamie, though, because for whatever reasons, I'm not quite sure what the reasons were, they were replaced, weren't they, very soon after this, you know. I think I might have heard, is it just because an incoming producer wanted a new set of companions, or I don't know, but...
Well, it wasn't an incoming producer, but they were all on fairly short contracts, which made them very easy to move on.
Right.
And actually, what I didn't realise until I started to investigate the Highlanders was that Fraser Hines had actually auditioned for the part of Ben.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
But he didn't get it. Michael Craze got it. And I suppose, as I say, I suppose I, as you just said, Ben's the man of action and the guy with all the physical strength and capability. And I guess I saw the Jamie character as being superfluous, unnecessary, I suppose. I mean, to be brutally honest, taking this story in isolation, I'm not sure what Jamie does to earn his berth aboard the TARDIS.
Yeah. Oh, I can see that very much in this story. I mean, you've said superfluous, and he certainly seems superfluous there, you know. It's I don't think he adds much to the story. But if you're asking me to answer the second part of the question, I absolutely adore Jamie, you know. I think he is, you know, if you were to ask me, Pat Troughton, you know, I've only got to say the Second Doctor and warm feelings pulse right through my body, you know. I absolutely so much adore the Second Doctor's portrayal, you know. And I just think, I don't mind whether it's Victoria or Zoe too much, but I do love Zoe as well, you know. And I just think that team together, they were just gold, and I just absolutely adore him. That's why. Do you feel that way about Jamie McCrimmon's character throughout the rest of his tenure, or is it this story that you think he's...
I think it's particularly his early appearances that make me hostile.
Right.
I think after he's managed to replace Ben as the alpha male of the group, I think things settle down a bit for me, because I accept, I grieve, and I move on.
Right, like with David Tennant and Matt Smith.
Well, yeah. But for example, I think we have to get it out there. Jamie, by virtue of his birth, is not particularly clever, is he?
Yeah.
He's quite limited. He's supposed to have this superhuman strength, which physically I don't think he can possess. You know, and his bravery is also legendary, but in this story it strikes me as totally contrived that, having been prepared to hang alongside Colin the Laird rather than abandon him, Jamie has no problem leaving him aboard the Annabelle bound for France so he can follow the Doctor back to the TARDIS.
What's that about? Yeah, no, it's all a bit of a mishmash, you see, isn't it? You know, and I think in this story, we can see, I think, it's a bit of a conundrum regarding characterizations and backgrounds and motivations and so, because this is where I feel we've got this, it's one of these stories where you're not really sure what is going on in terms of what was the motivation of this story? What was the actual driving force behind it, you know, because the characters, as you say, you know, are being, well, I suppose Ben's being usurped, I think, you know, but it doesn't happen in this story.
No.
And I think we can see, I would venture this, is The Underwater Menace the next story?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Right. Now, to me, I remember seeing that Rediscovered episode and seeing that Jamie's character was very much not Jamie's character in it.
And no, that's because he's doing Ben's lines for him.
Well, there you go, you see. He was, now, and there's an heroic sequence in there where he has to climb up rock face or something like that in there. And I think I could see that must have been Ben's. That must have been Ben's to do, you know. And because Jamie's out of sorts in there. He's not the character that we come to love later on in that story.
No.
And obviously, those are the reasons, you know, why.
Well, yes. I think we have to hold up our hands and say, whatever my personal feelings are about the takeover, Innes Lloyd must have seen great potential in the character. And given his longevity, there must have been more than a little wisdom in his judgment.
Because am I right in saying he is the longest ever serving Doctor Who companion?
I believe he's the longest serving male companion.
Ah, right. Yeah, because males don't usually last long in the world of Doctor Who, do they?
No, only if they're in the principal role, and even that's now being novelled.
Yeah, that's true. You see, it's one of these ones. It reminds me a little of you. You clearly love the character of Ben, and I loved him with his introduction in the War Machines. I think we've seen very little of him because not much exists, does it?
No.
And I think that, you know, that hasn't helped. If we could see some more, you know, then maybe his. You know, his stature within Doctor Who would grow, I think, with that.
I think that's almost inevitable with the discovery of more material.
Yes.
Because he's very good in The Power of the Daleks, isn't he?
Yes, oh, absolutely, yes.
Great character, as is Polly, actually. It's a good team.
Yes.
And because the team is good in Power of the Daleks, it makes me wonder why Jamie was needed. Because, as you say, he's the cuckoo in the nest, isn't he?
Yeah,
he is. He's the usurper.
Yes, yeah. I don't know the reasons why, you know, all of that happened, but for some reason, they were gone, weren't they? I don't know if... did he want to leave, or was it just...
No, I don't think they wanted to leave.
Ah, right.
I don't think they did, but who knows? I'm sure that they've told the... Or I'm sure that Annika's told the story many times over. But I think it did come as a shock, and I think it came as a shock also to Patrick Troughton, that they were moved on.
Right. Because it's interesting, it's put me in mind of Harry Sullivan.
Yeah.
Who I absolutely, again, love Harry Sullivan's character, you know. And he was brought in and then decided, oh, he's not needed because Tom Baker can do all the stuff. And he was cruelly got rid of, and I loved Harry, and you know, Harry and Sarah and the Doctor, they make great companions.
Why were they a great team, yes.
They were, weren't they, you know, and it's so sad when there's another character who wasn't allowed to shine so much and show his potential, you know. It's such a pity, you know. We could do with a lot more stories with those characters.
It comes down to the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yes, yeah.
And the TARDIS team was not broken.
No. Oh, very much it was not broken. I mean, it was... I mean, look at Genesis of the Daleks and Ark in Space, and it was fabulous. Absolute pinnacle of Doctor Who, and... Harry Sullivan, fabulous, you know. It's interesting, yeah. You've given me something to think about there, David.
Yes, that's all good. I mean, something else we must think about before we do the score, something we traditionally mention on these occasions, is the cover.
Now, of course.
Yes, now the cover illustration of the Highlanders is by artist Nick Spender, who painted other covers in the Target range, like Inferno and the Aztecs. So I suppose my question to you is, do you like it? And my second part to that question is it remotely comparable with the classic Chris Achilleos covers that so excited us during our respective childhoods?
Right, David, I'm going to give it to you straight here. I'm looking at this cover now, and it says nothing to me. Yeah, it says absolutely nothing. I'm looking at Jamie. It's clearly a, you know, recognisable, quite a nice painting of Jamie. In his, but not as we know him when we came to love him. It's very much in this first episode with the, I think, is it like a sort of classic sort of uniform on? I don't know if it's an officer's uniform or fighting uniform or something. It says nothing. I'm looking at this cover. It's what a mishmash for a start. Well, it's got, you know, it's got no hugely recognisable character from Doctor Who. I know, of course, you know, Jamie McCrimmon is, you know, very famous Doctor Who companion, but he wouldn't leap out at you as being, you know, the Doctor. He's no Sarah Jane, is he? You know, he's no someone to put on the cover to go, oh, I recognise that person straight away. Not only that, you've got, there is a misty covered TARDIS in the background. You've got, is that a big Scottish flag flying there?
Yeah.
I don't know, would that, you know, is that a good thing or a bad, I don't know. And it's, well, I'm just thinking, you know, if you're coming out from a demographic thing, to put the flag of a nation on the cover, I don't want to be excluded. I want to be included in it. I'm going to, and, you know, not, I've absolutely nothing, of course, against the Scottish. I'm just saying, why is this there? Is that something you immediately want to be drawn into? And then it's got a Peter Davison era neon logo on there.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a horrible Target logo, which is not a real Target logo at all. You know, it's in black and white squiggle of lines. And then it's got number 90. What does that mean?
It means it's 90th in the range.
That's what I always found an absolute strange... Yeah, because it's clearly not the 90th Doctor Who story, is it?
No, it's not. No, yeah. It's not. The target numbering's another subject in itself, because it's a total cock-up, for want of a better word. But I'm going to interpret the second half of my question and suggest that you don't find it as stimulating as a Chris Achilleos cover.
Is it that obvious?
It's pretty obvious, yeah. But I'm going to help you out here because I'm going to give you my interpretation of the cover.
Okay.
Because the cover seems to me to show a joint attack upon the TARDIS by a redcoat and a Highlander, or perhaps they're fighting each other with the TARDIS as a backdrop, whilst Jamie takes a selfie in the foreground, which is being photobombed by Alexander. Yes, I am pretty sure that's what the artist intended.
Do you know, I think you're spot on, David. I think you're absolutely right. It's true. Okay, David, should we go for a score for this? Do you want to go first?
Yes, absolutely. Very happy to.
Right.
We came to this audio knowing full well that it was one of the shorter Target books.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also a very valuable contribution to the range because it's written by Jerry Davis. And until I looked this up, I didn't realise, but he only wrote four books in the range and co-authored a final one, which was The Celestial Toymaker in 1986.
Really?
So it really is a book to be treasured.
Mm-hmm.
The packaging of the audiobook is fantastic. Annika Wills gives a very good reading, and it allows us to appreciate and engage with a story that we wouldn't otherwise be able to because more care wasn't taken of the original film cans.
Yeah.
And so it fills a gap in our knowledge about an early Patrick Troughton story, and at that level is absolutely invaluable. And my only serious criticism of it is that the soundscape is perhaps disproportionate. For example, I'm fully aware of what a door sounds like when it opens. So,
me too.
I think taking into account all of those factors, I'm going to give this one 7 out of 10.
Oh my goodness, that's... Well, I shouldn't be so shocked because clearly you've done a lot of analysis of this and a lot of... You know, a lot of thought has gone into that there. Now, I would say I'm going to give it a 5.
Mm-hmm.
5 out of 10. Yeah. I know I started off feeling very, you know, not at all enamoured with it, you know. But it has grown on me, and the things you've told me have made me like it even more. It's got a lot to like in it, but... As a story, you know, it doesn't strike me as worth more than the 5. It's pretty average in that respect, I think.
Mm.
Go on, David, what do you...
No, I must respect your view of 5 out of 10, but as I said, I'm sticking with my 7.
Yeah.
And on that bombshell, I'm afraid we've got to end this edition of Doctor Who on Target. But I do hope people will join us again next time.
Please tweet us at Doctor Who on Target, that's DR Who on Target, or email us at DoctorWhoOnTarget@gmail.com. That's the end of this episode, and I would like to thank BBC Audio and Penguin Random House for kindly supplying us with preview copies, and to Smerin's Antisocial Club for the use of their version of the Doctor Who theme tune. The biggest thank you goes to you, our listeners.